Today on the Scott Radley Show on 900 CHML.
Got the video stream going of the special Brantford City Hall City Council meeting where they're discussing whether to take the Hamilton Bulldogs to Brantford for at least the next 3 years. I'm guessing it's going to pass since at least one of the councillors is wearing a hockey sweater as he's talking. Might be a bit of a tip onto which way he's leaning on this one. But the question for us then becomes, okay, so we need to have our arena updated. It needs repairs. There's no question about that. It's 37 years old now, something like that, maybe older. This needs to be done. But in the meantime, if there are no hockey games, no basketball games, because the Honey Badgers left, the Toronto Rock isn't going to be there, so no lacrosse, no conventions, no concerts. That's a lot of nights of activity in the downtown. What is the impact on our downtown? Ryan McHugh is the manager of tourism and events at the City of Hamilton. He joins us now. Ryan, thanks for doing this tonight. I appreciate it.
Good evening, Scott. Thanks for having me.
Let's go to that first, right off the bat. And I don't know if we know the figure or if there's a way to calculate the figure, but do we have any idea of what sort of economic impact a quiet arena downtown will have for 2 or even 3 years?
So we do. In 2019, if you recall, Scott, Ernst & Young completed an arena study on behalf of the city. And at that time, they calculated the annual economic impact of that building of upwards of approximately $30 million per year. So absolutely, that's a large hole. And recently, that arena has been on quite the run, in addition to shows like Michael Bublé, Blackpink, the Korean K-pop band,
yep.
which had people come in from all over the world. This year, we have the Canadian Country Music Awards, as well as Shania Twain coming as well. So definitely been on a run. And you know, you're absolutely right. That is a hole that would need to be filled. And certainly, you know, as a city and whether it be BIAs and Chamber of Commerce, there's not one way to do that. But I'd love to talk about some of the things that as a city and Tourism Hamilton and economic development, we'll be doing to help fill that gap and should really move the needle.
All right, and let's do that because I would assume, and you can talk about my assumption first and then jump in. I assume sure. The city does not have in its budget $30 million to just simply to pay out to the businesses that are going to be missing that over the next year, $90 million perhaps if it's 3 years. So something else has to fill that void, I'm assuming. So what could that be?
That's correct. And so you're looking at other opportunities to fill that void. And you know, as you're well aware, I'm sure, Scott, Tim Hortons Field had a record year in 2022. So in November, we'll be hosting our second Grey Cup in 3 years. Also have the NHL Heritage Classic where the Leafs played the Sabres. The Ticats, hopefully they're making deep playoff runs, as well as the Forge and the Canadian Premier League, even the concert the Arkells had. So you know, leaning on Tim Hortons Field as a source of activation and economic impact will be important. As well, the convention center, meetings and conventions are starting to come back in a big way. As well, just looking at some of the creative uses last year, we had the Van Gogh immersive experience at the convention center. And over 3 to 4 months that exhibit was in place, there was over 60,000 people that went through that building. So that's not quite a full Bulldog season, but I'd say a healthy chunk. In addition to those 2023 opportunities, in 2024, we have the RBC Canadian Open. I know last time, Scott, we hosted that in 2019. You wrote a nice column about the considerable economic impact took place. So we hope to not only match that, but exceed that. And we're leaning on, you know, sport tourism, whether it be amateur sports, tournaments. This March, we have a bit of our own March Madness here in Hamilton. We have the CCAA Women's National Basketball Championships at Mohawk and then the U Sports Men's National Volleyball Championships at McMaster. So from a tourism perspective,
so there are things, for sure.
A lot of irons in the fire. But another one which is creates great uplift, and we had a record year. I'd love to talk a little bit about film, if I may.
Well, just before that, because you mentioned the Tim Hortons Field, and maybe we could use that more. Can that be used more? And the reason I ask is because the Ticats have to be able to practice and play. So setting up concerts or whatever else takes time. That takes away from their use of it. The Forge is there. And I know that Last year, the city made a vow that they were going to try and allow more use of Tim Hortons Field for community use, as was initially promised. So how do you fit more events into there?
Yeah, and that was a packed year. And, you know, to build that and elevate that would certainly be a challenge. But I know the Tiger Cats and the city will do everything in our power to try. But, you know, as I mentioned, there's not one thing we can do to fill that void, but a number of things. And, you know, as I mentioned, Scott, film is another avenue to create economic impact in the city. And last year we had a record number of productions, so over 170 filmings in Hamilton. So whether that be movies or TV shows, and just last year that created, you know, $72 million in economic impact. So, you know, just for scale, I spoke about a full year's worth of arena activity at approximately $30 million. Film, you know, is growing and growing quick, and that fills up hotel rooms, restaurants, employs a ton of people, and, you know, anything that gets Arnold Schwarzenegger to town.
But Ryan, that $30 million, and that's great. I mean, look, we love having the filming industry here, but that $30 million for the businesses downtown is still gone. Is that in any way recapturable, or are they just going to have to deal with deal with the loss of that for the next couple of years?
Yeah, so in the recently approved, would have been last year, the Economic Development Action Plan. So these types of transformational projects, such as the arena renovations and LRT, you know, there is a realization that these are disruptive, clearly. But in addition to having the arena offline, you know, the $100 million, which will be invested in that facility, will also create a great deal of economic uplift. That's significant construction jobs, even just anecdotally looking at all the cranes in the air in Hamilton from all the towers that are going up. If you walk around in the morning, you see construction workers going to get their coffee. You see them out getting lunch. And afterwards, when I walk by King Williams after my, I call it a day here at Lister Block, definitely see that pack. So the impact of $100 million making its way into that building, you know, that's $100 million that wouldn't have been spent otherwise. And just as a comparator, Baltimore, so the same partner, Oakview Group, so that was founded by Timothy Lewicki, yep, formerly of President Maple Leaf Sports and Entertainment. So in addition to $700 million investments in Climate Pledge Arena, $1 billion investment in the complex where the New York Islanders play, the UBS Center. They're just finishing up a $200 million investment in Baltimore at what will be called CFG Bank Arena. And based on local media reports there, that construction alone has created over 500 construction jobs. So, you know, that in itself creates uplift, and building these arenas and these skyscrapers, which are going up at a quick rate, not only does it redefine the Hamilton skyline, but it also creates a ton of economic impact.
It's going to be something that is certainly to keep an eye on. And if you're a downtown business person, I guess to keep your fingers crossed that this that investment pays off and that you can get to that investment. Ryan McHugh, really appreciate you taking time. Thanks for doing this today.
Thank you very much, Scott. Have a great night.
You're listening to the Scott Radley Show podcast on 900 CHML.
There is a study that came out. It was released today's the 7th. There you go. It was released today. It was by the Bank of Montreal, BMO Financial Group. And it asked people what they thought, what amount of money they thought they were going to need to gather together to hole up in their little mattress or RRSP or wherever they keep their money. How much money were they going to need to put away in order to retire? And let me just say that people, I think, are either optimistic or pessimistic. I mean, optimistic on the hand that they could get this much money tucked away. Pessimistic that, boy, it seems like for most people, this means retirement is out of reach. Because the Canadians said the amount of money they are going to need to retire is $1.7 million. Even Dr. Evil didn't go that high. He was only $1 million. If you remake Austin Powers now, it's $1.7 million. It just doesn't even work. That's a lot of money for most people to stash away. Especially when you consider that according to the same poll, the national average amount that people have in their RRSP, this is the average, so some have more, some have a lot less, is $144,000. That's a long way from $1.7 million. I want to bring in Thea Convery. She is a financial planner. She is a wealth advisor out of Dundas. I love having her on here. Thea, thanks for doing this today.
Hi, Scott.
If I am someone who has, even if I'm an average Canadian, if I have $144,000 stashed away in my RRSP, but I believe I need $1.7 million to retire, I'm screwed.
Well, not if you're 19.
Okay. How many 19-year-olds have $144,000 in their RRSP, though?
Probably not a heck of a lot.
Yeah.
But I suspect the time frame in which you have to continue to save and for your $144,000 to continue to grow certainly ought to be a factor as well.
When I heard this number, Thea, I actually read this twice because my first thought was this is what Bank of Montreal was saying you had to have stashed away. This is what Canadians believe they have to have stashed away.
Mm.
Where do you think that comes from? Because I've always heard that you need a million. And I know inflation and everything else, and I don't even know if the million is a reasonable number. But where do you think 1.7 million, because it's a weird number to just magically appear out of the ether.
Well, if I just propose, they didn't do this in the article, but if I just propose a 5% rate of return on $1.7 million, that will create $85,000 a year of income. Okay, consistent income on the $1.7 million. But of course, Canadians, most Canadians, would have CPP contributions on top of that. If you're over age 65, you'd likely have old age security as well. So I think that's where the number's coming from. What do you want to have to live on every year or every month? As Canadians, we kind of budget on a monthly basis, and then they back that up. Oh, if that's what you want or need, then here's the pot of cash you need in order to produce that that income.
Does this suggest, Thea, that Canadians are overly cautious? Because as you say, if you're going to have CPP and old age security and maybe a pension, if you're someone who's had a job who's got that, adding $85,000 a year to that seems like, boy, you either lived a rather lavish lifestyle or you're planning to when you retire or you're really concerned about something.
Well, if you currently earning $150,000 at your job, maybe you didn't start that young in your career, but you're later in your career, you now see retirement on the horizon, and with your skills and talents, late in your career, if you're earning $150,000, if it drops to that $85,000, boy, oh boy, that's nearly a 50% decrease in your standard of living. And I could only surmise any one of us, regardless as to what your income is, if it dropped in half at a time when, if you're thinking of doing more traveling and experiencing other things that you couldn't do in your career, that's going to be a pretty hefty swing.
When you talk to clients, how many of them, I was reading something just the other day about CPP and, you know, is the government actually flush to be able to keep CPP going? I know our rates just went up at the start of this year. How many of your clients are concerned that maybe when it comes time to get that, that it may not be there exactly as it was promised?
Well, let's split our two government pensions that we have. The old age security, which is age and residency based. You need to be a certain age and you need to have lived in Canada for a certain period of time. Now, that's funded from tax dollars. So as our governments, federal in this case, collects income tax, then they turn around and distribute that as part of the old age security. Whereas Canada pension is contributory. If you worked previously, self-employed or as an employee, part of your earnings would be contributed to the Canada pension plan. So if you were perhaps a homemaker, stayed home raising kids, or if you were a full-time employee for your career, then you likely had contributed to the Canada Pension Plan to the maximum. So everybody's CPP contributions could vary from the maximum to zero if you never never worked outside the home. So those two pieces, OAS funded by tax dollars and Canada Pension funded by contributions, they're both being stressed. As you might suspect, our federal government is has to watch their pocketbook. And so if you earn over a certain amount in this year, 2023, if you earn more than $87,000 and qualify for the OAS, you're going to have to give some of that back. So is it not going to be there? Well, they're already sneaking away at it. Whereas Canada Pension, they haven't clawed that back. That's the term they use for these the OAS pension. Instead, what they're doing is they're requiring employees, self-employed or natural employees, to contribute to that plan. And the percentage that you must contribute keeps sneaking up higher and higher. We don't really see it. So they're both of them are stressed, and the federal government, to keep those two going, claws back on one, the OAS, and asks for a little bit more as a percentage for contributions. So could they call the CPP back? Sure. They got to get those dollars from somewhere.
Let me go back to this $1.7 million because I have to think that not everyone is going to read the story or listen very carefully. They're going to hear $1.7 million to retire. Whether they even pay attention at all or not, because it seems so out of reach to so many people, it does seem daunting. I mean, for anybody who's getting close to retirement age, there's always going to be a little bit of nerves, maybe a lot of nerves about what you've stashed away. But boy, that is a figure that I think for most Canadians to hear that, you're just saying, what am I even bothering with? I have no hope.
Well, remember, the 1.7 was to create the income
right
that an individual might want. And as you said, if they have a pension plan, which fewer and fewer people are having those these days, that will bridge some of that gap. So we don't think of a pension as a pot of money, but in fact it is. And each of the pensioners get their share of the pot. So that will bridge some of the gap. Some of that 1.7 might be sitting in your pension plan. But as I said, fewer and fewer individuals now contribute to a pension plan. It's just not available. If we think back to our parents and grandparents, boy, oh boy, just about everybody was in a pension. The reason for that is they wanted to lovingly force employees to be setting aside funds for their future. The government actually thought that was a smart move, because then those folks will have retirement funds. And some of us, unless we're lovingly encouraged to set aside money, we won't do it otherwise. But now you'll see federal, provincial, even municipal employees will have those pensions, but fewer and fewer private employers are offering it. They might have a group retirement plan, or they may even set aside a certain amount of funds every year for the employee to put into their own RRSP, but the liability now to fund the pension is going to be switched from the employer to the employee, meaning you are now more responsible for funding that instead of your previous employer.
Yeah, and I'll say this. I mean, you at the very beginning, when we very first started, and we talked about the $144,000 the average Canadian has, and you sort of, I think, jokingly said, yes, but if you're 19, you've got lots of time. Okay, that's terrific.
Sure.
But let's say even if you're 30, now you don't, if you're 30, you may not have a pension. And if you want to buy a house, it's not the same as back when your grandparents were buying a house. All of your money is now going into paying the mortgage, to the point where you probably don't have a ton of money to put into your RSP, and you don't have that pension. It becomes a pretty scary thing that I would think that for a lot of people, their home becomes their retirement plan.
Well, that may be a poor strategy. So you are, in fact, correct, though. The younger you are, the greater the odds that you do not have a pension. So you'll have to self-fund. I mean, you were doing that in a pension, but it was forced to happen, and your employer was contributing as well. So the younger you are, the less the odds are that you have a non-government pension. And so you'll have to do it yourself. That's the first thing. But then the second thing is you are likely going to live longer, in which case I would encourage you to work longer. I think back to my grandfather, worked to the day he died, worked to 65, and back then the average life expectancy for a Canadian male, they didn't include gals in that calculation back then, but generally ladies were homemakers. The average life expectancy for a Canadian male when he retired at 65, the average life expectancy was 64. Huh. So that government plan is going to sustain itself forever.
That's right. It's running negatives at that point.
It's running, that's going to work just fine and dandy. But the average life expectancy for a Canadian today, male now, is just shy of 80, and ladies tend to live a little bit longer. But by the time we all get there, those numbers will progressively get higher and higher.
Right. So you live longer, thinking, you don't have a pension. And the cost to own a home or pay rent or something else is much, much higher, and all your bills are higher, so less money to put into your own pension. It's all working against you.
Well, you could choose otherwise. So granted, we've seen in this little golden horseshoe, we've seen housing costs that are increasing exponentially. But I encourage folks, don't buy your forever home if you're in the market to be a first-time home buyer. Do not be shopping for your forever home. Buy your first home. And that means it may not have the pool and the backyard and the four bedrooms and a finished basement. Shop for your first home. It's not forever. And that will keep your costs down. And then you can aspire to a different form of housing down the road. But the lower you can keep your costs at the front end of your career for housing and food and holidays and the like, the greater you can squirrel away at, in which case time will now be working on your side. First home, not forever home.
Yeah, see, I laugh about that only because we got to run. I laugh about that only because I am a victim of the curse of watching Home and Garden, or HGTV. And when you watch like Home Hunters or whatever, and you see the 26-year-old people go, we need to have 5 bedrooms and 3,000 square feet, and we need this. And I was like, okay. Mm. Now, you know, slightly different place perhaps if you're buying in Alabama than if you're buying in the Golden Horseshoe, but nonetheless.
Well, they will be compromising their financial futures if they are making those decisions.
It is. It's an interesting one. As I say, the piece today from the Bank of Montreal, Canadians believe they need $1.7 million to retire, which is up 20% in just 2 years. Okay. Thea Convery, she is a wealth advisor from Dundas. You can find her online if you would like to look her up. Thea, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it, as always.
The pleasure's mine.
The Scott Radley Show, weekday evenings from 6 to 8 on 900 CHML.
The Scott Radley Show podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Scott Radley. Thanks again for listening, and do not forget to subscribe to this podcast. It is free. You will never miss an episode. And also, be sure you rate us and review us. Whatever you think of us, we'll take it. Thanks for listening.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his 6-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his 2-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.